Great. Welcome. So glad you guys are with us. Is this exciting or what? You know, it's odd to call something exciting when it's such a heavy subject. So there's a level of seriousness and heaviness to it, but we're excited because we love Israel and we love the Jewish people and we love Ronnie and Tali, and I especially love Tali's name, his wife, because that's my daughter's name. But such a just wonderful to have them with us. Known Ronnie for many years. He's been a tour guide for us. Just an amazing man in many ways. Not just a great tour guide, but also really, I would almost say, a great Israeli historian. I mean, just such a vast knowledge that he has. And like I said, there's going to be a whole, what he's covering, I don't know for sure tonight, but I know it's going to be wonderful. So we're just happy to have them with us. I want to pray, and then I'll turn it over to Ronnie. But let's pray. Father, I want to thank you so much for Ronnie and Tali. What a blessing to have them with us tonight. And we pray for Israel. Have mercy, God, on the nation you so love, on the people that you so love. And we love them as well. We ask your continued protection, Lord, on the people of Israel, as well as even here in the States and around the world, as they're under such assault right now. And we thank you, God, that we can stand with them and show them that love. And I pray that Ronnie and Tali would feel welcome, and all those that are visiting with us tonight would feel welcome. And that tonight would be, again, sharing with friends and being excited about being with friends, but also, Lord, just the sober reality of what the nation is going through, and that we might get a taste of the heart of the people of Israel through Ronnie. And so just bless our time together, Lord, and we thank you and ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. So I don't want to take Ronnie's time in here. Ronnie, come on up. Let's bless Ronnie Simon. Welcome him. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Pastor Mark, for the opportunity to be here tonight. I do have an accent, by the way, as some of you can tell already. Get used to it. It's not going to change for the next hour. I'll try to slow down to make my message as clear as possible. I'm surprised to see the turnout, and that warms my heart up because it means that people do care and people do want to know. And I know that some of my message will be preaching to the choir, but many people tell me we want to make a case for Israel. We want to stand with Israel when arguing with friends and families. We are missing some information. Well, my mission is basically to share some information with you, and that's not easy to do. The message you'll hear from me today is not an easy one to deliver and not an easy one to understand. It speaks about war, it speaks about bloodshed, it speaks about hostages, it speaks about something very personal to every Israeli. We are a small country, we're a small nation, and when something happens, everybody is involved. So we do speak about an unprecedented event that took place little over 100 days ago. We were still in a stage of a shock, so to speak, trying to digest how did it happen and how we are going to make sure it won't happen again. And for those of you that thought that this is a local conflict far away from home, you're wrong. It's a global conflict. It was always that way. But now you cannot hide it anymore when the Houthis from Yemen, 1,000 miles away, are firing at Israel and closing the Straits of Bab el-Mandeb and stop all the trade through the Suez Canal. And 17% of the world trade goes through the Suez Canal, prices will start rising, including in this country, because things come from China through the Suez Canal, even to America. We're all going to feel that. When Iran, 1,000 miles away, is the mastermind behind everything, and the proxies all around the globe, and money from Qatar is the engine to fuel everything, and Qatar is the villain in the story, it's not a local issue. Another thing which is important to mention because it's on the table, you cannot hide it anymore, it's a war of religion. For many, many years, we tried to ignore that because once you speak about a religious war, it's a dead end. You cannot resolve anything because it's not in the hands of the politicians. You cannot negotiate in behalf of your God. He did not authorize you to do so. And once you bring religion to the table, that's the end of peaceful arrangements, of politics. It was always about religion, but we refuse to listen. So it's religion, it will be about religion, that's the nature of the conflict. An opinion of mine, when historians are going to write down the history of the world in the first part of the 21st century, They will say the following: it was a war of religions. The trigger was 9/11. The first battle was defeating ISIS. The second battle was to defeat Hamas. Same agenda, same people, same mindset. I'm guiding in Israel for nearly 40 years. I had the privilege to guide many Americans in the country. And my opinion was always that there was no difference between the two, ISIS and Hamas. It's the same agenda. And people told me, but ISIS had proven already to be that cruel, Hamas not. The answer was, we are there to stop them. Well, Hamas had a 24-hour window to show the world what really they are like. And I think that we're all convinced that Hamas is of the same nature. By the way, they were the first. Hamas was founded in 1988. ISIS executed the plan of Hamas. So Hamas was the inspiration. It's Muslim Brotherhood, Palestine. And if you want to know more about the Muslim Brotherhood, I recommend that you go and read the book of the founder, Muhammad el-Banna, from 1934. It's Hitler's Mein Kampf in Arabic, almost one-to-one. So we tried to hide that. We tried not to address that. Because if you know there is a problem that requires action, unfortunately, violent action, and we are sick and tired from another war and another one, but time is not in our favor. And therefore, for me to deliver such a message, it's easy to be very emotional about it. It's very personal to every one of us. I'll try to stay as objective as I can, but you don't understand, I cannot be totally objective. And there's so much biasness out there and disinformation that I don't want to add to that. If you do some cleanup, the nature of the problem is very simple. But since nobody wants to deal with simple issues because confusion is great, nobody knows what's going on. And sometimes that's the agenda. Let's add mountains of deception until nobody will have a clue what was going on. Well, some cleanup is necessary. I'm going to use the screens behind me, and I'm not a disciplined speaker, so you have three challenges this evening. Number one, get used to my accent. Number two, try to follow the screens over there and try to synchronize what I'm saying and the screen, which is not always together, okay? So if you need to choose one or the other, focus on me. I know it's very kind of a humble thing to say, but I'll stay on course sometimes. What happens behind me and in front of me is not well synchronized with the message. I'll go for about an hour, all right? We'll see how much we can dig into it, and then I'll be more than happy to answer questions if you have any, and every question is kosher. Can you say kosher in that regard? I'm not sure. It's legitimate, and I hope that you will be educated this evening on new things, and that will help, even as a tool, to make a stand for Israel and to have better information about what's going on. I want to start with the most painful issue, which is the hostages, and it's 109 days for the war, not 107. We are facing a situation that no nation had faced in the past. Nobody was required or was demanded, if you wish, to face such a situation. We are fighting a war in the tunnels of Gaza that no army ever fought in the past. We are learning how to do that. The most painful issue is the hostages, and because of that, I chose to put it as number one. Because there is a stated goal to the conflict, and Israel declared we want to destroy Hamas, but also free the hostages. It looks like these two objectives are contradicting one another. It would be very hard to accomplish both of them, and that's what is the fault line in Israel even today. What comes first? To rescue the hostages. Now you tell me, a baby that celebrated his first birthday, 1 year old, is a real enemy of Hamas and Islam. Women, children, elderly, civilians. 249 were kidnapped from their homes, those that were not butchered on the ground and were not beheaded and were not baked in ovens. I'm sorry for being gross, but these are the facts. Were carried to Gaza, some of them by simple Gaza, not even Hamas members. The fact that the walls were breached, 1,000 people came from Gaza, people who are not involved, innocent people with kitchen knives and scissors and axes to kill on the Israeli side. Who behaves like that? For years and years and years, we thought that we can reason because we are people and people have needs and we can sit at the table to find a solution. It's not working. It wasn't meant to work. We were deceived. And now we know the nature of our friends on the other side or neighbors on the other side. We'll have to take action. This has to end in one way only because the whole neighborhood is watching. Hamas will be destroyed. Maybe not the ideas of Hamas. Defeating Nazi Germany did not defeat Nazism. But we want to be in a situation that Hamas is not a government, And Hamas doesn't have any capabilities to do that again. If you talk to them, they say it loud and clear. We're going to do that again and again and again. I have to give Hamas credit. They don't hide their intention. It's out there. They speak it loud and clear in every language. We don't negotiate. We don't talk. We are going to kill all the Jews and Christians, by the way, something that you guys are ignoring all the time, but that's the agenda. I do not want to speak against Islam as a religion. I'm not a theologian. I don't have to. It's enough for me to see what Muslims are doing to other Muslims in behalf of their religion. For the last 15 years, what the media was calling the Arab Spring, how optimistic. The Arab Spring, sounds great, huh? More than 1 million Arabs were killed by Arabs in the Middle East during the Arab Spring. So don't tell me it's a religion of peace and love if that's how they behave and that's how they treat each other. Just imagine what they will do to non-Muslims. And we saw an example. An example in October 7th, and we had enough of that. So my plan is to try to give you the backstory, if possible, to try to focus on the key events, because to speak about Gaza today without knowing the past and the history, you're missing the whole backstory, and it is my plan today. I promise to try to be less biased as possible. Here is a picture that looks like the 4th of July, maybe, but it's not. What you see over there are rockets fired from Gaza on one side, and the Israeli Iron Dome is waiting patiently to intercept these rockets. It's an amazing picture, huh? Wouldn't you agree? And it happened almost every night, not anymore today, because the rockets are running down by numbers, and we destroyed many of them. But for a while, that was a daily issue. Every evening, a barrage of rockets came from Gaza. 92% of them were intercepted by the Iron Dome, so not that much damage was done. Here is the story of the Gaza Strip, a very small piece of property. It's only about 25 to 26 miles long, about 4 to 8 miles wide, 2.2 people. The most crowded place on the planet is indeed the Gaza Strip. You see how small it is, comparing the state of Israel, that's not big either. The whole of Israel is smaller than the great state of New Jersey, just to give it the right proportions. So Gaza covers a very small part of it, and that will be the map. I do want to show you the little timeline regarding the history of the Gaza Strip. Between 1949, we'll get into details in just a minute, until 1967, it was in Egyptian hands. In the 1967 war, Six-Day War, we conquered Gaza and the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt, and we had it in our hands. In 1995, after negotiating with the Palestinians, we pulled out from the land, gave it to the Palestinians. In 2005, we pulled out from the rest of Gaza, and then Hamas took it over from the PLO. We'll go into some details in just a minute, but let's go to the very beginning. I'm taking you back now to 1947. 1947, 30 years of British mandate over Palestine came to an end. We speak about the years after the Second World War. Great Britain won the war but lost the empire, and they occupied Palestine. It was a mandate given to them by the League of Nations that preceded the United Nations. And after the war was over, Britain decided to leave the area, and they knew that if they are leaving Palestine, there will be a problem. Two people fought for the land, the Jews and the Arabs. And Great Britain was aware of the problem, and they knew that if they are leaving without trying to find some kind of a peace settlement, it will end with a bloodbath, which happened basically. And they asked the United Nations to come over and see what can be done. A team was sent over, 9 members, and the plan was we are going to meet with Jewish leaders, we're going to meet with Arab leaders, we bring them to the table, we'll negotiate, we'll find a solution. The Jewish leaders, more than eager to negotiate, these are the years after the Holocaust, 6 million Jews perished in the Holocaust. Whatever the world would offer as a homeland for the Jews, we could not decline. The Arab leadership had a different opinion. This is Muslim territory. The Jews have no rights in it. We are not negotiating. Once Great Britain is leaving, we are going to throw the Jews into the ocean, period. So even if he wanted to try to find a settlement, that wasn't realistic. And this delegation, very frustrated, decided that the only way to end this place or this conflict peacefully is to divide the land into two. It's going to be divided to a Jewish homeland, to an Arab/Palestinian homeland. I'll hesitate to use the term Palestinian because they were not born yet as a nation. I know it sounds amazing because you all thought that there was always an Israeli-Palestinian conflict. You're wrong. Before 1988, Not even the Arab countries believe there is a nation called Palestine, let alone they deserve a land. This is a new conflict, okay? But very clever propaganda was able to place that issue as a central, pivotal issue to world peace, etc. Nonsense. But that's what people think about today. There was always a Palestinian people, always a place called Palestine. There was no such entity, and there isn't such an entity. There is no place called Palestine. It's a sentiment. There's no passport, and no country, and no government. There is no such place, okay? Just to be practical. Well, who am I to tell 5 million people that believe they're a nation, you're not a nation? It's not really helping the cause. But practically, you won't see a Palestinian passport. There are no Palestinian passports. There's no currency. There's no history. All right? But this is not the point for tonight. So the delegation was asking the General Assembly to vote for the plan. And on the 29th of November 1947, the world had voted for the resolution that will be called Resolution 181, the partition plan. The land called Palestine, and when people chanting and screaming from the river to the sea, not having a clue what river they're talking about, well, we speak about the River Jordan on one side, Mediterranean Sea, that will be divided to two national entities, one for the Jews, one for the Arabs. Jerusalem will be an international city, an enclave of Jerusalem and Bethlehem, and not part of any of the two countries. That was the plan. The UN voted for it. It's passed, and hallelujah, problem over, two countries for two people. If I'd ask you how many countries were actually born after this resolution, you will tell me that only one, the state of Israel. How come there is no Palestine? The UN said very clearly, it will be two countries for two people. The Palestinian state was never born. And if you don't know your history, and that's why I'm here, the answer will be the Palestinian state was not born because you, the Jews, conquered the land. And for that reason, there is no Palestine. You're wrong. Let me show you what happened. Well, that was the plan originally, the partition plan. That's how it looked like. Since the Palestinians refused to take it, when Britain left the area and the Arab armies invaded Israel, we were very fortunate and successful to conquer more land that was allocated to the Palestinians. If you start the war and you lose some territory, don't complain. And after the war was over, these are now the borders of the state of Israel. This will be Palestinian territory, and this will be Palestinian territory, but it wasn't. Because when the war started, the king of Jordan was sending his army to help the Palestinians, his brothers. And after the war was over, he decided to leave his army in the area and not to give it over to the Palestinians. So the area called the West Bank of the Jordan, it's a geographical term. Let's use the biblical name, Judea and Samaria. The biblical heart of Israel is indeed the West Bank. This place was supposed to be part of the Palestinian state. The king of Jordan decided to stay because it was lush land, it was beautiful, and simply annex it to Jordan. The Egyptians that were supposed to come and help the Palestinians from the Gaza, from the Sinai Peninsula, simply decided to keep the Gaza Strip under their custody. It was not annexed to Egypt officially, but these territories were supposed to be Palestinian state. And therefore, Palestine was not born, not because of Israel. Most of the land that was allocated to them by the UN was in the hands of Jordan, the hands of Egypt, the Jordanians, and the Egyptians refused to withdraw. They kept the land, and that's the reason why there is no Palestine until this very day. So there's a new map now in the region, in the area. That will be the state of Israel. That will be part of Jordan. That will be part of Egypt. So the Gaza Strip was created basically by the armistice after Israel defeated the Egyptian army and conquered all this area from the Egyptians in 1948-49. What was left in their hands will be known later on as the Gaza Strip. There was no Gaza Strip before 1949. Well, the city of Gaza, the southern coast of the land of Canaan, to use the biblical term, the Gaza Strip was created basically as a result of the ceasefire, the armistice between Israel and between Egypt. That would be the situation. The population in the Gaza area were predominantly refugees, people who fled during the war of 1948 from the area of Jaffa and Lida and Ramle. By the way, Israel is accused for this refugee problem. Let me tell you what, and please check me out. By the way, don't believe to anything I'm saying. I have an agenda. I cannot be trusted. You go and check. If you find better facts, I'm open for a debate. But you won't. When the war started, the Arab leaders made an announcement. You Arabs of Palestine may be caught in the line of fire because we are coming with the mighty armies to throw the Jews into the ocean. Come and take shelter in our country just for the time being. And after we deal with the Jews, you go back to their homes and you take their homes much nicer than yours. 85% of people that were called refugees until this very day left their homes before the war even started, invited by the leaders of the Arab countries. Well, they lost the war and they're not coming back. But many of them went down to Gaza. 80% of the population of Gaza today are refugees. By the way, the title refugee is very interesting because there is a lot of international agreements who will be called a refugee. Only the first generation of refugees is recognized to be as refugee. In the case of the Palestinians, the UN made a special arrangement. UNRWA was founded in 1949. In the case of the Palestinians, you can inherit your position to the fifth generation, just in the case of the Palestinians. So why do you want to solve the problem? You're making more money on the list of UNRWA for welfare than you're making working in Gaza. Why even work? So you're not really helping. UNRWA was supposed to rehabilitate refugees. Not even one was rehabilitated. And UNRWA officials are Hamas members, basically. You hear some bitterness in my voice because the world ignored at the same time that these refugees went down to Gaza, about 700,000 Jews had to leave their homes in Iraq and Egypt and Syria and Lebanon, and they lived there from the days of Nehemiah, long before Saddam Hussein. Guess what? They had to leave the homes because when the rumors came from the battlefield that the Jewish army is prevailing, their lives were in danger. They are refugees as well, just like the others. Did you ever hear the term Jewish refugee ever? I don't think so. All right, so speaking about fairness and speaking about double standard. So now we have the Gaza Strip, and we have it full of population, mostly refugees. So until 1967, I'm sorry, that's what you need to see. Until 1967, it was indeed in the hands of the Egyptians. If you were a Palestinian now who lived in Egypt, in the Gaza Strip, you had no rights whatsoever. No citizenship. You can hardly find a job. You can hardly get an education. The one thing the Egyptians did is to build all kind of militias, the Fadayun, to carry the struggle against Israel. And I'm saying that because the world accuses us for apartheid, which is absolutely nonsense. Let me show you apartheid. A Palestinian who lives in Egypt, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Kuwait. He doesn't have an official citizenship. He's treated like a dog. Zero rights. That's apartheid. The only country that was accommodating them to make them civilians was Jordan. So 70% of Jordanians today are basically Palestinians. If you are an Arab who lives in Israel, you're an Israeli. You can be a member of the Knesset, the parliament, you're voting, you can be elected, every position is open to you. In the supreme judges that we had, some of them in the Supreme Court are Arab judges. The winner of what would be the American one, American Idol, the equivalent in Israel, was an Arab. We even have a lot of cooking programs, huh? Isn't that popular? Sometimes the winners are Arab cooks. Apartheid? You must be kidding. People that don't have a clue will point the finger to say that Israel is an apartheid state. The one thing that the Arabs are not required to do in Israel is serve in the army. All the Jews go, we go to serve in the army. The Arabs can volunteer, but they don't have to. They have their property protected, their civil rights protected, and they call us an apartheid state. You want to see apartheid? Go to Lebanon, go to Iraq, go to Kuwait, go to Syria, go to Egypt. You'll find apartheid. But nobody cares about that, huh? It's just Israel, the one which is being measured by a different standard to speak about an apartheid state. Some data. Lifespan in the Gaza Strip until 1967, 48 years. Today, 78. We built the clinics. We built the hospitals. We brought them life. Infant mortality, 55 to 100,000, down to 6 today. And we are accused to be the apartheid nation and the apartheid state. Go and check the figures. It's out there. It's not Israeli figures. It's the UN, international research organizations. So these are the facts. And as I said, don't believe me. I cannot be trusted. You go and you check on your own. So now when Israel took the Gaza Strip from the Egyptians, it was in our hands for a few years. In the midst of that, we started negotiating with the Palestinians over a potential arrangement. Oslo Accord, some of you may have heard about that, in 1993. Yitzhak Rabin was prime minister, Yasser Arafat, the head of the PLO, and we thought that it's about time for reason and logic to prevail, and we're going to leave behind all the hatreds. We'll try to work for peace. It looked like it's impossible, but I do want to make a distinction important for you to understand. The PLO is an organization which is based on nationalism, the Palestine Liberation Organization. They do not have a religious agenda. And therefore, that was common ground. We are not going to negotiate religion. We're going to try to find something reasonable for the best of two people. Let's stop the killing. It will have to work. What we did not understand back at the time, that the PLO was not representing all the Palestinians. We thought that when you get a deal with Arafat, all the Palestinians are included. Hamas was founded in 1988, and they said, we are not part of the PLO. And therefore, we are not under any obligation to keep anything that the PLO signed in our behalf. Now we know the new answers. Back in 1993, we did not. So we made a deal with the Palestinians, and the deal was that we are going to pull out from territories in the West Bank and Gaza, give it over to the Palestinians. They will build their Palestinian autonomy that was built in July 1st of 1994, and we are going to look at you very carefully to see how you deliver. Here is a piece of land. You show us that you can govern it successfully. You show us that you are collecting all the illegal weapons, and you educate your kids in a peaceful way and not on hatred, which is the main key, by the way. How do you educate the next generation? So we left most of the Gaza Strip, and you do see those enclaves that were left, which Israel kept. But most of the Gaza Strip is now in Palestinian hands. That's Gaza City, that's Khan Yunus, and that's Rafah, the three big cities in the Gaza area. Guess what we got in return? Well, definitely not peace. Since we're out of part of Gaza, that became to be a haven to all those terrorists because Mr. Arafat had no intention to work for a two-state solution. It was an opportunity. They called it the salami plan, if you wish, slice by slice. And before not too long, we started hitting by rockets that were made by the locals and bombs, and our few communities that were still in the Gaza area suffered terrible casualties. Back in the days, if a kid wanted to go and visit his friend in the next community, the family car had to be escorted by helicopter gunship. Otherwise, you're not leaving the safety of your community. And since we said this is not going to work, we need to find another plan. So between 1967 and 1994, I just covered almost all of it, so if you would like to read it, please, and if not, that's fine as well. But for a short time, it looks like it's going to work. We've built a brand new airport for the Palestinians in Gaza. There was a harbor, holiday villages, hotels, beautiful beaches. It looked like it's going to work. It didn't. Because when terror started, we just said, what's going on? We made a deal. You're enjoying prosperity for the first time ever. You have a chance to be a real nation. Why do you do that? Well, the answer was, of course, I'm not controlling my own people. That was Arafat. That is the motivation. That's the agenda. They simply fooled us, and more than once. So when we understood this is not going to work, we initiated something else, and that will be what was called the disengagement. Some of you may remember the name Ariel Sharon, and I'm skipping that. Ariel Sharon was prime minister in Israel, very hardliner. By the way, the first time that a rocket was flying into Israel was in 2001, the town of Sderot that was rocketed by thousands of rockets. A whole generation of Israelis is growing in bomb shelters. Now listen, we are much stronger. We can take Gaza out in a very short time if we don't care about civilians. It was always the way that democracies are fighting war in a certain way. Innocent civilians should not be in the line of fire. Today what happens is that the gloves are off and everybody is a terrorist. So things are a little different today. But back then we still thought it has a chance. So you get one rocket and another one. You go to the town of Sderot, beautiful town. Every 100 yards there is a little concrete cube which is a bomb shelter. You go to your daily business and suddenly the siren sounds off and you have to run for your life. And when they start rocketing, usually at 7:45 every morning, what happens 7:45? Come on, you know the answer. Kids go to school, right? And those kids have 8 seconds. 8 seconds to find a shelter or to lie flat on the ground. It happens for the last more than 20 years. Nobody should live like that. We did. And we did not nuke Gaza. We thought there was a chance. And not everybody is a bad person. And we find the right leadership. We really want to be integrated into the Middle East, accepted by the Arab countries, and working with the Palestinians will be like a precondition to be accepted into the Middle East and be part of the Middle East. Not working. 2005, Ariel Sharon decided to initiate what will be called the disengagement plan. Israel is pulling out of Gaza. 2002, President Bush delivered a message on the 22nd of June, and he said in his message that it was always America's vision to see a two-state solution. Well, it wasn't until President Bush said it so clearly, which is fine, because the plan had a second part that said in order for that to happen, the Palestinians have to surrender their weapons and have to stop the terror. And since we knew it's not going to happen, we said, okay, we are going to go with the roadmap for peace. And that's the plan on the table, the two-state solution, basically. So Israel decided to show the world that it's not enough to appease the Palestinians. It's not enough to pull out from territory. That's not the real intent. Protecting our civilians in the Gaza area was simply impossible. Every community was protected by a brigade. Israel is not such a large army. How many brigades can you dedicate just to protect civilians? And therefore, the disengagement was a plan that Israel will pull out from Gaza. It came to conclusion in September 11th of 2005. There are no Israelis, not even one, in the Gaza Strip. So when you see people marching with those stupid signs, free Gaza from whom? Maybe from Hamas. There are no Israelis in Gaza since 2005, not even one. We left behind greenhouses and drip irrigations and communities and synagogues. All of them were destroyed. You idiots, you need to eat. Use those facilities. Oh no, the Jews built it, we're not going to use that. 70% of unemployment in Gaza, when the world is pouring money in for them to build an economy. They come to work in Israel. We feed them. And those people that came to be fed by us are those that betrayed us and led the attack on October 7th of 2023. Same people. They knew how the communities looked like. They knew the people. They had pictures in their hands. They knew exactly where to go, to what house to fire an RPG. And they did that while they came to work and feed the families spying on these communities. So now we have a new situation. Israel is not in Gaza anymore. And by the way, Gaza borders also with Egypt. If there was a problem, let the Egyptians feed them. Why do we? You give me one example of one place around the world. The two people are at a war, and one is supplying the other with food and pharmaceuticals and fuel, where the other was determined to destroy you. Who does that? Oh, we do. We try to distinguish terrorists from innocent people. Are there innocent people in Gaza? I believe there are. I just don't know who these people are. They don't speak up. And therefore, the 2005 disengagement changed everything because we understood that we have a major problem. And problem means we are going to screen everything that goes into Gaza. We are going to check that what goes in just for people. But once you cross the borderline, who seizes all that material? What do you think? Well, Hamas does. By the way, we decided to send in cement because people need to build homes. Where did the cement end? Building tunnels in Gaza. Not a single house was built. Everything was used to build tunnels, 500 miles of tunnels. There is no such place on the planet and never was. So 2005 and on was a turning point. And from 2005, we're out, but Hamas is not in yet. They're going to come in full power by brutally murdering their brothers and sisters. Elections. Since everything was part of a political procedure and the U.S. was deeply involved, it was an opportunity to show the world that Arabs can live in a democracy as well. By the way, there was not a single Arab democracy. All right, there was one called Lebanon, which is in total chaos now because of the democracy. And I'm not criticizing, not everybody can live in democracy. It was an opportunity. Ms. Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State back at the time, was all behind the process. Observers came to watch and to see that it's a legitimate procedure and people are running and there are no kind of tricks, etc. And we just made a suggestion, if you let Hamas run, they will win the elections. It won't be a democracy. And Ms. Rice said, well, it's a democracy, and that's what America is supporting. It will be free elections. Guess who won the elections? Now, if you win the election, 75% Hamas, people that voted for Hamas knew exactly what they're voting for. The agenda is there. I urge you to Google Hamas Charter, November 1988. It's all there, no secrets. If you vote for that, don't be surprised that that's what you're getting. So Hamas won the elections, but the PLO that was still in power refused to relinquish the weapons, which led to a civil war. So Gaza experienced a short time of a civil war. Hamas won big time, and the PLO was not only defeated, they lost a lot of people. By the way to get rid of PLO officials by Hamas is to take them to the top floor in the high rises in Gaza that we leveled recently and just push them down to their death. And it happened by the hundreds. The hundreds of people, even today, pushed by wheelchairs because they had a bullet in the kneecap. That's how they treat one another, the Palestinians. So now the Palestinian people are divided into two. Hamas is controlling Gaza. The PLO is controlling the West Bank. These two don't like each other. We cannot speak about one Palestinian nation. They are divided politically and religiously. That will be a given situation, and that's where we are right now. Let's have a word about Hamas, so we'll get to know this group of people a little better. So from 2007, it's indeed Hamas that rules the Gaza Strip. We speak about a militia which is motivated by religion. They don't have a national agenda. They aspire to found or to build the caliphate, just like ISIS did, which means that idea is that if you divide the Arab people, or the Muslims, I'm sorry, to nations and states, you are defeating the purpose of Islam. A division to national countries is weakening the Muslim cause. All the Arab Muslims should stick together to create a caliphate. By the way, when the head of Islam is from an Arab descent, his title is a caliph. When he's not Arab, he's a sultan. Let me clarify something which will confuse you, but everything confuses anyhow. There are 1.4 billion Muslims in the world. Most of the Muslims are not Arabs. Countries like Indonesia and Malaysia and half of Nigeria and Iran and Turkey, all these are Muslim countries, but they are not Arabs. An Arab is not a religion, it's not an ethnicity, it's not a nationality. It's a lifestyle, it's a language, it's a culture, it's a civilization. And not all the Arabs are Muslims. There are Christian Arabs as well. Just in Egypt, about 20 million people are Christian Arabs. I know it's confusing, but these facts are important to know. And therefore, we speak about the Arab-Muslim aspiration to build a caliphate, and therefore you don't speak about nationalities, you speak about one entity that all the Muslims are fighting under, Sunnis, not Shiites. So if you're not confused so far, that will confuse you as well. Sunnis and Shiites are not friends. They only come together on one thing, the hatred to Israel. So the Muslim area or the Muslim world is also quite divided. Now, we don't care. Being selfish in that regard, I know what happens on our borders, and the end result will be the same. Let's read a couple of paragraphs from the Charter of Hamas. Article 13, you can read that, come to the conclusion. So what's the point in negotiating and try to find an agreement? There's only one way to end the issue. Jihad means basically to kill all the infidels, and that's you and me, all right? So there's no room for any kind of negotiations. By the way, for years, that was the mindset, and the second part was, send us food, please, because we are starving to death, and we did, and we did. Let me read your ear for yourself. Article 28, the letters in red, and you tell me what you make out of it. Interesting, huh? They will not forget when the Jewish soldiers stood in the blessed Dome of the Rock and they cried out, Muhammad is dead, he left daughters behind. I don't remember that I ever cried it out, that we left daughters here. What nonsense. But that's what Hamas charter is all about, and that's what we are facing basically. These guys are merciless, and they will not hesitate to lead their people to suffer. The way they see the struggle is that their civilians are protecting them. They are not protecting those civilians. The civilians are the first line of defense to protect Hamas. The assets, their bunkers, their arsenals, they're using the people as human shields, and say it loud and clear. A Hamas official was asked about 2 months ago, how come you do not prepare tunnels for the population? Why just Hamas terrorists are going to hide in the tunnels? The answer was the population of refugees, the UN should take care about them. We don't care about the population. How do you fight that? When Hamas is willing and interested to sacrifice as many Palestinians as possible, you don't have that much leverage to fight against such a group. So dead Palestinians is good for Hamas. Dead Israelis, excellent for Hamas. Dead Palestinians is bad for Israel. Dead Israelis, very bad for Israel. You don't understand the equation here, but that's where we are standing right now. That's how they operate, and they won't hesitate to rocket even a crossing through which food is being sent in. Because when Gaza is hungry, it's excellent for Hamas. They can always accuse the brutality of the Jewish state for that. So Hamas doesn't care much about what happens in Gaza, and what you see in the last 3 months will be the proof of that. Here are some of the famous characters. The head of the PLO, the president, Mahmoud Abbas Abu Mazen, who is totally out of control. The world wants us to negotiate with him, but he cannot deliver anything. 87 years old, not in control, but he is the moderate one. The man denied the Holocaust more than once, but he is the good guy that we're supposed to talk to. The others, Hamas, are not talking to anybody, and they're not interested in discussions. It's all about jihad. Hamas is operating not just in the Gaza Strip. They have big strongholds in the West Bank as well, all around the world. It's a proxy of Iran. Orders are taken from Tehran, and they're operating not just in the West Bank and Gaza, but other places as well. After Hamas gained the Gaza Strip, Israel decided to have a blockade on the Gaza Strip. You want to feed them, we ask the Egyptians, you feed them, they are your brothers. We have no such obligation. Because the people say that Gaza is like a big ghetto. There's no access. No, you're wrong. There is a border of Gaza and Egypt. I don't remember anybody puts pressure on the Egyptians to supply food into Gaza, just Israel. And we do. So everything comes to our harbors, Harbor of Ashdod. We screen everything and we send it in. And to prove to the world that there's nothing missing in Gaza, we ask Egyptian journalists to come and visit the Gaza Strip, and you read the reports over there. Again, I didn't make up any of it. The Egyptian journalists were shocked to see how easy life is in Gaza compared to Egypt. All right, so starvation and people are miserable, nonsense. This is not me saying that. That's an Egyptian reporter that came to view things in Gaza. We were surprised to see that life in Egypt is much harder than it is in the Gaza Strip. So this blockade that we have the right to do that, by the way, by international law. We only let in what's necessary for food over there. By the way, you do know that if you're a farmer and you're using all kinds of chemicals, it's easy to make a bomb out of it. But you need them as fertilizers. So how do you find that? If a farmer in Gaza needs potassium and needs magnesium, that's how we fertilize the land. But these two chemicals, plus some others, will make a great bomb as well. So are you going to let it in, or are you going to forbid that? You understand our dilemma. So Gaza was not starving to death. The Gazans did quite well, which always convinced us. Life is not that bad. They have a lot to lose. If they do launch such an attack, they're going to lose all of that. How little we knew, now we know. All the money that was sent by the world into Gaza was used to build tunnels, and most of it came in secretly. I mentioned Qatar earlier. Qatar is the one that finances everything. So Qatar is sending to Gaza $30 million every month, which is the legitimate one to pay Hamas officials in Gaza $100 for a family for a month. You don't do much with $100 in America for a month, right? Well, in Gaza you do. But the big money was coming in secretly, and the big money was the one that financed all those tunnels. And I'm telling you, 500 miles of tunnels, we thought about 200, now we are in there. And we are shocked to see the amount of weapons and the amount of ammunition and the amount of bombs and the tunnels. And these are not locally made. We speak about standard weapons. How did they get into the Gaza Strip when we have the blockade on Gaza? Well, through tunnels that come from Egypt. Egypt refused or did not fulfill its obligation. We pulled out from the Gaza Strip. The Egyptians were supposed to flood all the tunnels from Egypt into the Gaza area. They did not. And Hamas kept digging tunnels. So everything in Gaza is not locally made. It's coming from Libya. It's coming from Iran, from North Korea. And every day in the news, Israeli soldiers are exposing and are finding another bunker and another workshop. It's amazing. A countless number of weapons and rifles. 80% of the houses have piers that go down to the tunnel or the metro, as we call it. We knew that something happens, but we had no idea of the scale of things as it's revealed now. So we speak about tunnels and we speak about rockets, etc. Let me say a word about the Israeli policy. I'll be careful here with your permission. I do know that Mr. Netanyahu is quite popular in the US of A. I won't say much about his popularity. I'll say the following. He's holding office for 16 years now. And once you hold office, you are responsible. All right? And he had an idea regarding how to handle the issues vis-a-vis Hamas. Until then, the idea was that if Israel wants to make peace with the Arab world around us, we have to resolve the problems with Hamas. And then all the others will join in. Hamas will be the tough nut, all right, to crack. But once you make a deal with them, that will draw to the table all the others. You have to resolve the issue with Hamas first. Mr. Netanyahu said, not so. We are going to try to work with the Arab countries like the Abraham Accords, which was a great success, by the way. The Emirates and all the other friends of ours, and the Saudi Arabia, very close to kind of a peace treaty or normalization. That was his idea. We're not going to speak to the Palestinians. We're going to try to normalize the situation with the Arab countries. And then they will press the Palestinians so hard that the Palestinians will have to capitulate. They'll have to compromise. It will be easier to deal with them with all the pressure of the rest of the Arab world. It's a legitimate policy. Problem was, it wasn't working. Because it can only work under one condition. You need to keep the Palestinians separated. Which is, if you want to undermine the position of the PLO, you have to support Hamas. We supported Hamas. Not officially, God forbid. Everything happened under the table. But the policy of Israeli government was that you want a strong Hamas and not a strong PLO. Israeli cabinet ministers were saying that Hamas is an asset and the PLO is a liability. And to make sure that they function, we open our borders. We took 18,000 workers from Gaza every day to work in Israel. And we thought that they're going to build an economy. They will have something to lose. So why attack Israel? Knowing that if you do, you're going to lose everything. That's how logical people think. But this is not about logical thinking. So that would be the idea. And that would be the policy. And since we knew that Hamas is digging tunnels under the borderline into Israel, we decided to build a fence. And the fence was supposed to be the ultimate solution to the problem. It was full of electronics, and it goes about 70 feet underground. Impossible to dig a tunnel under because the water table is very high in the Gaza area. It will be flooded. The fence will solve all of our problems. Hallelujah. No, it didn't. It didn't, and it didn't because of a reason that we've learned a lesson. I'll share that with you in just a minute. It wasn't just the fence. It was a whole buffer zone about 100 meters, or 300 feet or so wide that nobody was supposed to cross to come closer to the fence. And we have our defense system over there and radars and sensors and everything was ready. It wasn't working. As I said earlier, everything was coming into the Gaza from tunnels from Egypt. And we did not know about that. We thought that the fence is going to be the ultimate protector of the country. Well, it wasn't. Think about people that live in communities along the Gaza Strip. The country promised them, you're safe. It's okay. No way that anybody can cross from the other side. And if anybody does, we are here to protect you. That was the whole idea. Think about a generation that lives a daily life that every single minute the siren can go off and you have to run to the bomb shelter. Nobody should live like that. And it's amazing what you can get used to. There are children in my country that's the daily life. So since this was not working, and again, we built the fences, here is what happened. And let me just skip this one to show you the one down below. Let's say that you have this buffer zone that nobody's supposed to cross, and you're watching carefully, nobody is indeed crossing. Forget about the screen over there. And one day you see a kid plays with a little football and just kicks the ball into the buffer zone area and goes inside to pick up the ball. What will you do? Are you going to shoot him? I'm asking you. Not really, just a little kid. Following day, a farmer shows up, a shepherd. He's walking with the sheep, and some of the sheep are going astray into the buffer zone. He goes in to clear the area. Are you going to shoot the sheep or the shepherd? Nah, not really. And before not too long, we have thousands of Palestinians rolling burnt tires against the fence, creating this big smoke screen over there. Just peaceful demonstration, huh? Look how peaceful that is. And inside this smoke, people are crawling to the fences, attached the bombs to the fences. Everything was ready for the attack. I can tell you that when this will be over, and once again there will be a buffer zone, if a tiny baby is crawling across this line, we'll kill him. We've learned the lesson. I'm sorry, it doesn't sound pleasant, because we'll have to create something after this war is over, and that something will be similar. But now we won't be that merciful and won't be that compassionate. So small steps, one after the other, until you get those smokes right on the border. You cannot see anything. The detectors are not working. The smoke detectors are not working. They were very, very successful to deceive us, and they did a great job in doing that. And they did that because they knew Israel doesn't kill innocent civilians. I'm afraid that maybe we'll have to next if that is going to repeat itself. And then, of course, the big day arrived, so to speak. I was walking the dog, 6:30 a.m. My phone rings. My daughter is working for the Israel news media, and she never calls me at 6:30. Nobody calls me at 6:30 in the morning in a holiday. And she said, "Dad, where are you?" "Walking the dog." "Well, go back home as quickly as you can. A barrage of 2,000 rockets is coming your way." We are used to rockets. It's not new to Israel. We're not used to people infiltrating, invading, breaking through defenses and go into communities, murdering people in their beds, men and women and children were beheaded. What kind of a monstrous mind will cook a baby in an oven, huh? You tell me. And they were stupid enough to film everything, because the story is, oh, Israel just invented, never happened. It's just a Jewish story. Well, they filmed everything, and they were very happy to do that. Some of you may remember the phone call that was intercepted. A Palestinian Hamas terrorist is taking a phone from a woman he just murdered, calls his father in Gaza. "Dad, I killed 8 Jews with my very hands. Your son is a hero." And the father is in tears. "Keep killing my son. I wish I could be with you." Who speaks like that? We are dealing with monsters. It took us a while to understand that. And let me say once again, if you think that this agenda is limited to the Middle East, you're wrong. The agenda doesn't have any borders, okay? So, October 7th of 2023, holiday, we speak about Sukkot, the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles, and everybody's home. There was a music festival about 10 miles away from the line. I heard the other day a French philosopher gave an interview, and he had a very interesting view. Well, that music festival, they played really loud music. People were dancing that close to the border. It's a provocation. It's a provocation. These people in Gaza are so poor, and you really want to press them by playing music on the borders? What an idiot. But that's the response that you hear from people around the world. People that go to play music and dance, it's a provocation to the spirit of Islam. In a very short time, they're able to breach the wall in 22 different locations. They're well trained for that. They went into our communities, some army bases, and the killing started. In my country, every house is a bomb shelter. And if the house is a high riser and there's no time to go to the bomb shelter, every apartment has one room made of fortified concrete. That's the family's shelter. These shelters are protecting you against rockets. Not against somebody in the house, because you can open it from inside. So the problem was to try to keep the handle so nobody will open that door. And people did it for hours just to hold the handle so nobody can open the door from the outside. Because the concrete protects you from bullets. You cannot fire an RPG inside the house. And some succeeded, some not. We lost 1,000 civilians that day within hours. A colossal failure of our side. The army wasn't there. The government wasn't there. It will be investigated. I wish I could be a fly on the walls of the army headquarters just to listen to that. I'm too old for that now. If they call me now, we are in trouble. But you do understand, something was dead wrong. On every single level, nothing worked for 24 hours. And then we recovered, and then we moved in, and we are determined to make sure that Hamas will no more exist after this war is over. And this is not an easy warfare, because we are fighting a war that no army has the experience how to do that. Armies will come to learn from Israel how to do that, because this may be the new warfare. Not the Russians in the Ukraine, and not the U.S. in Mosul. The U.S. just provided air support. The battle on the ground was done by proxies of Iran. Yes, America cooperated with Iran in order to destroy ISIS in the city of Mosul. It's a new thing. It's a new thing, and we're learning how to do that. So the music festival, about 400 people were simply murdered. They did not know the festival goes on. It was just a bad luck in a way. When the rescuers came, they saw a big fire from a distance. They came closer. They did not understand what's burning. And they came a little closer. They piled up more than 150 bodies and set them on fire. Just imagine to try to separate them to know who was in this fire. Who are the people who are dead? Everybody had a name and a family. You need to extract some DNA. You can't do that after a while. So even today, we have some people who are missing. We just don't know what happened. When you see rescue workers using the equipment of archaeologists, you know that something is bad. Because the archaeologists, when they dig something, they use big sifts and they are sifting everything. What stays on top can be pieces of pottery, if it's archaeology. Maybe some coins, in this case, a part of a tooth, a part of a bone. Just to try to identify the people that were simply burned to death. It happened in homes in these communities. And to make it more tragic, the people that lived in these communities by the Gaza Strip were the people that did believe in coexistence. They were helping the people in Gaza, which they knew in person sometimes. There was a couple, 85 years old, that used to drive to the border crossing because Israel provides medical care for Gazans who need it for free. They used to bus them and take them in their cars to the hospital and back to Gaza. They were the first victims. And the person that kidnapped them knew exactly who they were. He knew the house. Who behaves like that? Look at that. You see the cars on both sides of the road, right? That's what was left from this music festival. Miles and miles of cars. Many of them were totally set on fire. Look at this pile of stuff. Teams went in later on just to try to retrieve whatever was found in the car to try to identify the people. And you took some hitchhikers, anybody into the car. You don't even know who went where. It was impossible to find out. Let me show you a short video, and there's no really audio, but I was in this kibbutz about a week after it happened. Kibbutz Be'eri, the one that took maybe the hardest hit. Come on. Some images from Kibbutz Be'eri. The kibbutz that was hit the hardest from the murderous attack of Hamas. Until 2 weeks ago, happy families used to live here. This was a house with children playing out on the green grass. It was beautiful. It was a little paradise. And that's what was left of it now. It's not pleasant to see. And you see that in too many communities close to the Gaza Strip. We spoke about the hostages. This is one of the main tragedies that we are facing. And you do understand that the two objectives of the war, as Israeli government basically laid them down to the army, to the people, is to rescue the hostages and destroy Hamas. Unfortunately, these two contradict each other. It will be very hard, all right, to finish up Hamas and believe that we can rescue all these hostages. We do know for a fact that 25 of them are killed already. We have no idea where they keep them, but you do understand that when we are attacking a certain target, one thing we consider may be the hostages in that tunnel. So that makes everything a lot harder for us to plan to operate. And they are playing a brutal game, Hamas. It's a psychological terror. About 2 weeks ago, they showed a short video clip with three people, all alive, talked to the camera. And the headline was, this video was made a week ago. We'll show you tomorrow the condition of these three. And they did release a video the following day. Two dead bodies in the corners of the room, and the girl is still standing. and it will happen again, unfortunately. So this will be the main dilemma that we have regarding the next operation in Gaza. So once again, the picture of the enemies of Islam, people that were kidnapped by Hamas terrorists into Gaza, some were released, some are back with us. This is Kfir Bibas. He celebrated his first birthday a week ago, someplace in the Gaza area, nobody knows where. You would assume that the Red Cross will go maybe to check, huh? You must be kidding. The Red Cross doesn't care. But they reminded us that we should treat the prisoners of Hamas in our prisons by the Geneva Convention. Very important to remind us. They're prisoners in our prisons. They can order food from restaurants, visited by doctors, lawyers, family, and they can have academic education. Yes, we have zero information about our prisoners, which are held in the hands of Hamas. I do want to add something with your permission. Give me 5 more minutes. We'll bring that to conclusion. And for that reason, I do want to convince you that although most of the attention goes to Gaza, but it's not the only front that we are confronting. That's how parts of Gaza look now today. We are engaged simultaneously with some other battles in the area, which are on a different level of intensity. Number one, Lebanon. In Lebanon, there was a war going on ever since the war with Hamas started every day. Israelis are not maneuvering. The army is not moving in. It's simply firing at each other. We evacuated 70,000 Israelis from the towns along the border not to get hit. All the livestock was lost. Most of the orchards, nobody picks the fruits and the trees. And keep in mind, some of you have been to Israel. We have some good fruits and vegetables, okay? Israel is number 3 in the world, 3 in the world in absolute numbers, not per capita, in fruits and vegetables. And that comes from a desert country. All right, we speak about a lot of hard work of people to make the country that used to be covered by swamps and marshes into a small paradise. And right now, not all of it can be really cultivated. So Lebanon will be one of the immediate issues, and I'm sorry to tell you, this will not end peacefully. Because just like Hamas had their commander forces, so does Hezbollah in Lebanon, a proxy of Iran. We said it loud and clear. Hezbollah should have positions at least 20 miles away from the border, and if you don't do that by diplomacy, we'll do it for you. So right now, it's kind of a game that we play. There are some casualties, but it's not a full-scale confrontation, but it will be. And since Hamas is part of the Lebanese government as well, it will be a war between two countries, Israel and Lebanon. The Lebanese hate it, by the way. But the Lebanese are not strong enough. Hezbollah is a proxy of Iran, a state within a state, and they have the upper hand. When it comes to the Lebanese affairs, it's not a government, but it's basically Hezbollah and Iran. We have militias in Syria, and they're also proxies of Iran, and they have weapons that can fire at Israel. We do have in the West Bank some issues because Hamas is very strong in the West Bank as well, and all that happens simultaneously, but in different levels of intensity. We are determined that by the time this conflict is over, that will be the line of Hezbollah. This is the northern part of Israel, Galilee, Sea of Galilee, Golan Heights, some of you have been there. That should be the new line of Hezbollah, 20 miles away from our borders. Otherwise, we will not be satisfied. So this is going to be the next conflict, and it has to end in one way only, in a complete Israeli victory. The neighborhood is watching, and by the way, the whole world is watching. We have much support from European countries, governments, no Arab country supporting Hamas, but officially you need to show solidarity. You talk to them behind the curtain, so to speak. Hamas is illegal in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood was outlawed. Same in Jordan. The only place Hamas operates is in the Gaza Strip. Everybody wants to see the destruction of Hamas, but they won't see it loud and clear. Because the mob in their own country will present a problem. So we are working behind the scenes, so to speak, and that will be our goal. It has to end up in such a way. The West Bank, we did mention that. I do want to show you the outer circle. The Houthis from Yemen. You tell me what they have got to do with Israel. Well, proxy of Iran, the Straits of Bab el-Mandeb are under their control. About 17% of the world trade goes through the Suez Canal, not anymore today. You have to go through the whole continent of Africa, adding 4,000 miles to the journey. It's going to affect the world economy, at least for a while. And then we have, of course, Iran, the mastermind behind everything. And the real villain will be Qatar, because all the money comes from Qatar. Qatar invested in American universities $4.7 billion over the last 15 years. And if you give the money, you also dictate who is the professor and what's the curriculum. So don't be surprised that there was a hearing in the Congress and the presidents of MIT and Harvard and Penn State, when they were asked about the code and protocol of universities, they said that killing the Jewish people depends on the context. That's what they said, three times. So under some circumstances, it's legitimate. In America, you have a problem. We know how to deal with our problems over there. Look at the Europeans. Millions are marching the streets of London. Europe is freaking out. They did not know how big is the problem in Europe. It was a wake-up call. And maybe it's good that it happened. Because not too late to change the things, but that was definitely a wake-up call. So that's what we are confronting, basically. And fear not, because we are capable to protect ourselves, and we develop the best weapons in the world to do that. And some of you heard about the Iron Dome, and some of you heard about David Sling or the arrow. The arrow was used for the first time effectively to intercept a ballistic missile from Yemen. So the whole world is interested. By the way, because of the Russian-Ukrainian war, Western Europe is freaking out from Russia. They do not have any weapons to defend themselves. Guess what they are going to do? They bought the arrow already. Made in Israel, the money is American. Thank you, guys. Technology is local. This system is going to protect Germany and France and Britain and all of Western Europe from potential Russian barrage of rockets. Here is an irony of history. Jewish weapons are going to protect Germany. Interesting, huh? So they made a deal, and we are working to demand, to supply the demand, but that will be the new way to protect Western Europe by using the arrow. Back now to the opening slide. Well, quite amazing when you see that. I can't exactly answer the question. I can tell you this. A month ago, they took a poll in the West Bank. 82% of the people in the West Bank, Palestinians, are supporting Hamas, including the massacre of October 7th. So are all Palestinians pro-Hamas? I have no idea how to answer that. But when you carry the naked, the dead body of an Israeli girl to the streets of Gaza, and everybody comes to spit on it and comes to beat it up, are the good people in Gaza? When you're replacing the hostages, and the Israeli hostages are taken by the Red Cross, they only provide the shuttle services to the other vehicle to go out of Gaza, and the mob is standing there spitting and yelling and cursing, are there good people in Gaza? I don't know. Maybe there are. If there are, I have no idea how to find them. Because you need to understand, we try to do things by the protocol. And the U.S. is pressing us quite hard to do things by the protocol. It's an election year in America, if I know correctly. And the president is under lots of pressure in his own party. And we understand that it's politics. But the demands that we have in order to keep getting support are demands that no army can match. Impossible to operate under such restrictions. But we do our best. So in army headquarters, one of the gentlemen behind the table is a lawyer, specialist in international law. His only job is to give the justification if a target is legitimate, yes or no. And if he says we cannot take this target out, we don't take the target out. We don't want to be sued in the International Court of Criminal whatever because of that. No army ever acted like that. Once you're inside and somebody fires from a house, the house will be taken down, yes? You do understand the nature of this conflict. Well, folks, I have to apologize, number one, for the aggressive tone that I was using, but you don't understand how personal this thing is to us, especially the hostages issue. And I hope that you are, I can't say really enjoyed, but you understood at least part of the message. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to stand here tonight before you and to deliver that message with you. And once again, do not trust anything that I shared with you. Go and check. Go and check. There's enough deception out there, enough propaganda out there. I don't want to add to that. But basically, it's a simple story. Two people fight for the land. One is willing to make compromises, and the other one says, no, we're going to kill you. That's the bottom line. The rest, mountains of deception. And by the way, the fact that Israel is willing to negotiate doesn't mean that we're giving up on the biblical promise. The Bible says very clearly, what is the land God gave to the Jewish people? The idea is that for now, to stop the killing, and for now, to stop the misery, we are willing to make those concessions because only God knows the timing when these prophecies will be fulfilled. But when God is with you, who can be against you? Thank you.
Guys, have a quick seat again. If I understand if you have to go, I know with the time constraint, a little bit longer evening, but great. It's wonderful. I say great in the sense of informational. That word doesn't seem to fit with what we're talking about. So when I say that, I don't mean it in that way. I just mean very informational, which is wonderful. But Ronnie has agreed, if you have any questions, to do a question and answer time for just a moment, see how long that goes. If you have any questions you want to ask. So I want to turn it back over to Ronnie and just take a minute if you have any questions. So,
yes.
I understand that most Israelis serve at least 2 years in the military. Why are they not armed since you live in a country where you have so many enemies? They know what they're doing with the weapons. Why do they not have weapons that they can access when they're attacked?
Thank you for the question. Every Israeli boy, when he turns 18 years of age, is going to serve his country for 32 months. It used to be 3 years until about a year ago. It's now to 32. It will go back to 3 years. We need other people. That will examine the Arabs that can volunteer if they want to. And the ultra-Orthodox Jews are also exempt. Many Jews who live in Israel, I know it sounds bizarre, do not believe that Israel is part of God's plan. They believe that the regathering of the nation, as the Bible speaks about, will happen in a split of a second, miraculously, by God himself, and that will bring peace to the region. And they claim that since Israel is not a theocracy but a democracy, and ever since the country was born there is no peace, it cannot be part of God's plan. And therefore these people refuse to participate in part of daily life in Israel, including serving in the army. So it's not mandatory for them. Those kids that do go to serve, they are fully armed. Depends on your position, obviously, and what is it that you do. Civilians can carry if they want to, but you need to have a permit. I hate to think that everybody will carry a gun in Israel. That would be quite chaos. But those communities along the border, those that were supposed to protect themselves, they did have guns. They were they had the training, they had the guns, but they were told constantly, don't worry, the army is here to protect you. And therefore, to minimize the case of stealing those weapons to be used by criminals, they were stored in an armory. And people died on their way to the armory to grab the weapons because the army wasn't there. Why wasn't the army there? That's another story. I don't have time to go into that. It was a colossal failure. So people are indeed armed, not everybody. But the system was supposed to work. And every kibbutz is definitely capable to protect itself for 48 hours, including everything, if you are prepared and if you have the weapons. And something was not working there. Again, it was the perfect storm in a negative way. Nothing worked in October 7th of 2023. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Thank you. I understand that Iran has nuclear capabilities now or enriched plutonium. Is there any plan for a preemptive attack to negate that?
Well, Iran officially doesn't have nuclear weapons, but you're right. Whenever they want to, they'll have it. It's too late to stop them. Regardless what your president says or my prime minister, Iran will have nuclear weapons. All right? And the question is now not who has the weapon, who is protected from the weapon. And we have the Arrow and some other systems which guarantee 99% of success. But that 1% they do not guarantee can be the problem. The Arrow, supposed Mark III, supposed to intercept all those ballistic missiles outside the atmosphere. So there'll be no foliage, no radioactivity, and everything is going to be fine, assuming we are successful to do that. To launch a preemptive attack against Iran's nuclear weapons right now or capability is a little too late. We did that against the Iraqis in June of, when was it, 81, I believe, recall correctly. Everything was concentrated in one location. You take out one plant, you destroy the whole program. The case of Iran, it's divided to 12 different locations that we know of, maybe more than that. It will take more than just one Air Force to deal with that. And of course, the retaliation. So if it's going to happen, and maybe it will have to happen sooner or later, it will take more than just Israel. It will take a coalition of maybe Western countries, once they understood what is it that we're all facing. If that's what will have to happen, it will happen. Let me give you a scenario which is more philosophical than warfare. Let's say that somebody in Iran decided to press the red button and a nuclear missile is fired at Israel. We intercept it. No damage was done, no casualties. Do we have the right to respond with our nuclear weapons that we never admitted that we have, knowing that Iran is not protected and hundreds of thousands will die? What say you? Do we have a permission to do that? It's a philosophical issue. I have no idea how this is going to be resolved. But Iran will have the weapons whenever they please to. They don't going to go above a certain point. But with a nuclear weapon, you have enough alert. You can't just fire it out of the blue. It takes preparation, it takes a few days. You need to transfer some ingredient to put them together. Satellites can detect that. It cannot happen as a surprise, but it can happen. So again, in order to take out their project and their program, it takes more than just one Air Force. If the Western world will come together, strong enough to do that. But the Western world, so far, didn't show that much courage in dealing with things, and it can be too late in a way. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Any idea, I hear these outrageous amounts of death that they're talking about from the Palestinian side.
And I assume that those numbers are in the favor of the Hamas, if you could address that.
Question about the numbers of casualties that you hear in the media. Number one, you need to know that. There is no international media on the ground in Gaza. Only Al Jazeera, which means that all the figures and all the data is provided by Hamas. You want to trust them, believe them, be my guest. The problem is you watch TV and you see the commentator sits in the convenient studio and you know that he saw things with the very eyes. And if not, somebody from CNN is on the ground in Gaza reporting what they saw with the very eyes. That's not the case. The sources are Hamas. You stop an ambulance driver, and he will not tell you that instead of driving people who are injured, he's driving weapons and ammunition in an ambulance. All the figures are given by Hamas. I do not know how many people died. The report is about 25,000. I have no idea how to count it. The problem is they're all innocent civilians, amazing. Just tell us how many terrorists were killed. You don't have the figure. It's always civilians. In one case, they reported the death of children before the war even started. And it's always children. Looks like Gaza only has children in the Gaza Strip. Not a single adult, not a single terrorist. I don't want to laugh at it because people getting killed, yes. But the numbers are given by Hamas. The famous Ahali Hospital, some of you may remember. 10 minutes after it happened, the whole world media, Israel bombed the hospital, 500 people were killed. If you can count 500 bodies in 10 minutes in all the chaos in Gaza, you must be something. And then we intercepted a phone call that one Hamas operative called the other, said, the rocket in the Ahali hospital, it's your fault. You fired it. Me? Yes, yes, we saw it coming. It was your problem. They didn't know that we listened to the phones, obviously. And suddenly the numbers are shrinking, amazing, from 500 to about 15 to 20 people were killed in the parking lot of the... That's the nature of the reports from Gaza. 2,000 rockets that Hamas fired fell inside the Gaza Strip. The more we push them down south, the range is not enough, it falls in Gaza. Can we say that each rocket killed 5 people? You've got about 10,000 casualties just by friendly fire. Nobody will tell you that. So nobody knows the numbers. It can be 20, 25, 30. Many of them are still buried under the ruins of high rises. I understand that. But I'm telling you, if there was a pier in your apartment that was dug under a baby's crib to go down to the metro, you are a legitimate target, will take you out. And it looks like 80% of the houses in Gaza have those piers that go down to the tunnel. You see how easy it is? You can be a Hamas terrorist and you fire your AK-47, you're dressed in civil clothing, and you leave your rifle in the hiding place, you leave the house, you're not a target. Somebody can come instead of you, pick up the rifle and keep shooting. We do not shoot at innocent people. Yes, collateral damage, definitely. That's the unpleasant outcome of every war. Any idea how many people died in Iraq during Desert Storm or during the other war from 2003? No numbers were published. Interesting, huh? Nobody published the numbers. Well, the US or the UN estimate, 500,000. Anybody makes a big issue out of it? There was a war, and war takes casualties. Sorry. We learned our lesson. And that will be the lesson. Israel will not have a terror entity on its borders, no matter what. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
What's the stability of the Israeli government right now? I mean, I'm reading stories where Netanyahu is starting to get pressure to move him out.
Well, the question...
My question was, what is the stability of the Israeli government right now? Reports in the paper are that Netanyahu is being pressured to move out. And if there is a change in leadership at that level now, what's the anticipated impact on the war?
Well, in this case, what we need is stability in the government. And for that reason, we have a unity government. Some members joined in that were not part of the coalition. It's a different system in Israel. All right, in Israel, they need to form a coalition. And I know it's absolutely crazy compared to yours. And you know what they say about the Jews? Where you find two Jews, you'll find three opinions. Our politics definitely shows that. And therefore, when you vote, you're voting for a party. And the party that had most of the votes, the chairman, is called to the president to try to form a coalition. And since we have in the House, the Knesset, 120 members, you need to have 61 at least to form a coalition, which means that you're negotiating with other parties and try to lure them, if you should try to convince them to join the coalition. So you are in the hands of your partners to the coalition. The coalition today has 64 members in it, and now others join in to have a unity government. And how stable that is, I can't really tell. So far it's working, but not without problems. And what we need now is stability. We simply need to carry on to win this one. And after that, the real problem will start, because this solidarity that we have is only for the time being. I'm more concerned about what will happen in the Israeli society after the war is over. All right? You're expecting some integrity from your leaders. You expect them to take responsibility. They don't do that. The chief of general staff, the Israeli, day after the attack, came forward straight to the camera. We failed. My job was to protect you, and I failed. We are going to finish the war, and then he will resign. That's integrity. We have a prime minister that refuses to take any responsibility. The failure has a name, has a face, has an address. I'm sorry about it. I know that Mr. Netanyahu is popular in America. He is responsible. He'll have to pay the price. The question is he going to resign after the war is over, or maybe blame everybody else as he does right now? Because I'm not being cynical here, not being sarcastic. So we'll see. Right now, it's working. In order to change the system and have a new government, which is doable without elections, all we have is two members of the coalition, not to defect, but to change sides, saying we don't trust this cabinet of war, we want a new one, and then you lose your government, and without elections, the parliament can appoint another government and keep going. Or you can have a vote of non-confidence, and then the whole country is in chaos. But when so many people are in uniform, they cannot really vote, you're defeating democracy's purpose. You want everybody to be able to participate, and that's hard to do during wartime. So yes, a lot of criticism, I have to say. And again, the man is an Israeli patriot, was a great leader for a while, but that failure happened in his shift. The problem is that politicians don't take responsibility. And for me, that's poor leadership. I don't want a leader that cannot say, listen, I tried, I was wrong, I'm going home, let somebody else do that. Sorry about that. I know that Mr. Netanyahu is very popular in America. But that should be the case in every government. You cannot be the prime minister for 16 years and not be responsible. You just cannot. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Yes, you touched on Bible prophecy earlier on.
There's a little click over there because we can't hear you. Oh, just go ahead. I'm going to repeat the question.
Can you hear me now?
No.
Okay. You touched on Bible prophecy earlier, and I was wondering what your take is on Ezekiel 38 and 39, especially with you having attacks coming out of the north now, and you mentioned Iran, obviously, and Russia is also seems to be a concern, so I was wondering what the take is on y'all's position with Israel in that prophecy.
I have a very short answer to give you, and please take it as I'm saying it, all right? I don't do theology. I don't do prophecy. Check with Pastor Mark. I'm sure that he'll have an answer for you. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
The day after the 7th of October, it seemed internationally all of the international organizations that fight for Israel's demise had their toolkits ready, and they're on the streets, they were ready. And how does Israel understand that? What is the analysis of that?
Well, in one word, I will call it anti-Semitism. I know it's not an easy term to use, especially in America, but that's exactly what it is. If you measure Israel and the way we behave by a different set of criteria that you measure anybody else, that's anti-Semitism. I did not see the students in Harvard demonstrating against Russia where they bombed hospitals in Damascus. Yep. Okay, so
my question really is, do you think that some of the international organizations like Students for Justice in Palestine, etc., does Israel think, or do you think as an individual, do you think that they knew?
I see. Now, let me repeat the question. Right? The question is, did people know about the attack? Some journalists were there on the ground, and all kinds of organizations instantly had something to say, to comment, if they knew about the attack. I don't think so. But this is a fertile ground to all kinds of conspiracy theories. I'm sure that once the rumor spread in Gaza that the wall is breached and everybody can come in, including with the mob that came to rob and to kill, some journalists went in as well. And they were accused for that, by the way, because some were freelancers for CNN. And we said, well, maybe you knew about that. And there is a limit to journalistic integrity as well. You can be a journalist. If you see a crime committed in front of your very eyes, you need to get involved. So did they know that in advance and joined Hamas knowing that that was going to happen? It will have to be resolved maybe in a court of law someplace. But I don't have a good answer for you because I don't know. Sorry. And the last one. Yes, sir.
How does the population of Israel view the United States and our president, our State Department, our military, our involvement with this? Be honest with us.
I'm a tour guide, not a politician. But you asked me to be honest. Most Israelis are not that educated about the U.S. and the political controversy, and they do not know that there is a group called Evangelical Christians that do support Israel. Many do, but not everybody. And therefore, the way they know American politics is what they see in the Israeli media. And you complained about the liberal media, we can give you lessons about the liberal media. I can say the following. America is a friend, always has been. Presidents come and go. As long as the people have an overwhelming majority of supporting Israel, we are content. President Biden stated loud and clear, music to our ears, that he is a Zionist. No president ever said that. It's a good thing to say, especially when Israel is in such a need. By the way, to be a Zionist means that you believe that the Jewish people have the right to live as an independent nation in the ancient homeland. That's Zionism. Regardless of your religion, nationality, if you believe in this room, I believe that all of you are Zionists. If you believe that the Jewish people have the right to live as free people in the land of promise, that makes you a Zionist. And therefore, to send two American carriers to the Middle East, backing Israel up, not that we needed that, it was a nice gesture. Fortunately, Russia is busy elsewhere, because if Russia was still with boots on the ground in Syria, that will lead to a major problem. Russia is no longer there, so that was possible. So once we hear about the financial aid that we are getting, and about the support from the US, the Israeli public that doesn't know much about American politics is quite content. We know that this is an election year, and we know that anybody can be elected, either Mr. Trump or President Biden. Nobody knows how this is going to end. We do believe that whatever administration exists in America, they will be pro-Israel, and that's the only thing that we care about. I need to tell you that when Bill Clinton was president, he was admired by Israelis. All we knew is a young, handsome man that speaks for Israel and was for Israel. We don't care about Monica Lewinsky. That's your problem. We don't care about, is the man has integrity, yes or no? That's what we see. So that's the way that we view the American politics and leaders. President Biden so far has proven himself to be a friend. And we do understand that there are some problems in the party over there, and he has to please the progressives one. He doesn't want to lose some of his constituents. We understand that. But all things considered, can it be better? Maybe it could. When President Trump officially proclaimed Jerusalem as the capital and the U.S. recognized all the Golan Heights, it was a great gesture. And that's why the position that I'm representing just for myself, I'm not a state official, all right? Presidents come and go. And if you have an unpleasant regime like Obama's administration, we know how to deal with it. Waiting for the next elections, things will get better. It's not just the president. As long as the people in America, 51% of them, I know there's more, support Israel, we are very thankful and we are content. You wanted me to be honest. That's as honest as it gets. Yeah, please.
Just a simple question, but is it a coincidence that in 2005 the disengagement was on September 11th and then we were attacked on September 11th? Or is that just a coincidence?
No, we started in August, and that was a very unpleasant procedure because Israelis lived in the Gaza Strip. We had to evacuate 8,000 people that didn't want to leave, and most of them were religious Jewish people. And the rabbis told them it's not going to happen because it's against God's will. They refused to leave. The state tried to encourage them by offering a very generous package, house for a house and compensation for losing property, etc. And many of them refused to do so. And once it did happen, you understand the crisis. Your rabbi, your leader advised you not to go because it's against God's will, but it did happen. So was it God's will, yes or no? That was a local crisis then. September 11th was just a coincidence. You keep moving people, you destroy your infrastructure. And so it happened that the last man that locked the gate behind him, that was September 11, 2005. Folks, thank you so much. And I hope that you learned something new tonight. I know that you're friends of Israel. I know Pastor Mark for many years, and he's a friend of Israel. And I'm sure that the church is friends of Israel. We need friends. We need friends. We need your prayers. We need support. When I started doing this, I stopped counting after 150 trips to America, so I don't really know how many I did. But I understood quite quickly that more than I want to share with Americans about Israel, I need to go back home to tell my people how much support we have in America. So you are blessing us by actually being here. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you. You know, as we finish up, guys, I just want to say, you know, hearing Ronnie give the definition of what a Zionist is, it's good to know, and of course, I would expect Ronnie to be a Zionist and those that are there in Israel. I know that I consider myself a Zionist. Many of you, and maybe all of you in this room, do as well. But God made a promise to Abraham that he'd given it to his descendants forever, which means God is a Zionist as well. And that may be politically incorrect, but we don't care. We're Calvary Chapel. Lord, thank you again for Ronnie and his beautiful wife, Tali, getting to come with him and travel here. And I pray, God, as they're here for the remainder of their time, you'd bless them, keep them safe, watch over them. We pray, God, you'd watch over Israel and keep it safe. We pray, God, you'd watch over those soldiers going into the Gaza Strip. And Lord, not if, but when they have to deal with southern Lebanon, we pray you watch over the soldiers there as well. And Lord, that truly, by the time this is done, the world will know there is a God of Israel. And Lord, that we stand with them. And we thank you, Lord, for the opportunity to do that. So we thank you for tonight. What a blessed night it was. And we ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen. God bless you guys. Thanks for coming. Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning in to our live stream. We love and appreciate every one of you. If you're in need of prayer, please call the number on your screen or visit the prayer page on our website and let us know how we can pray for you. If you're into social media, be sure and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Also, subscribe to our YouTube channel and ring the bell to be notified when we go live or post a new video. And lastly, you can download our church app by going to calvaryknoxville.org/app. Thanks again for watching, and God bless.